It could be something to do with the shock of having been affluent, had a car and servants and lived in a mansion, and then finding yourself in a hovel or a mud hut. The shock might stimulate the memories. Another point worth remembering is that it's not creditable to remember a previous life in a better family or higher caste, because that implies in the Indian system of karmic belief that you've been in some way wicked, so you have been demoted. Sometimes spontaneously a child with memories will be able to describe how death occurred in the previous life. That happens in 60 to 70% of cases, particularly if the death has been violent, which is a common occurrence in our cases. Violent deaths vary from one culture to another, as high as almost 80% in Lebanon or Turkey, as low as 25% in British Columbia and around 50% in India. The rate of 82 violent death in our cases is far higher than it is in the general population. A possible explanation is that a violent death is better remembered by the informant. I think violence has something to do with fixing the memories in the child. Violence entails physical suffering and an abrupt termination, which may tie in with this longing that children have to go back to the other family. They seem to want to see how they are doing, and once they meet the other family, that sort of desperate nostalgia diminishes. It's often asked why more children in Asia seem to remember previous lives than Western children. Are the memories fostered by a belief in reincarnation in Asia and suppressed by the disbelief in Western countries? That may explain some of the differences. We hear quite often from the parents of Western children that they wished they'd known all about our research when their little boy was 3 years old, because he was saying, "I used to be a pilot and I was shot down. We told him to stop telling fibs and now he doesn't remember anymore." Example plus more plus book Soul Survivor, The Reincarnation of a World War II Fighter Pilot, https://books.google.no/books. It equals SN1 Emagak Bagent Print Sec equals front cover and DQ equals soul plus survivor plus ninja and HL equals no and SAR equals X and reader underscore escape equals Y hash V equals and a page and Q equals soul. The biggest challenge thrown up by the idea of reincarnation is whether people are something more than a combination of genes and the family environment. If you disregard the evidence we have collected, just think of the way the average Western parent regards his or her child. It's exactly the same as one regards an automobile that's come off the factory line. There was nothing before these bolts and bits and pieces of the car were assembled and painted. That is the standard view that Western parents have of their children. They make the child, starting with the genes, the collision of sperm and ovum, and that colors their entire relationship with the children they have. If anything goes wrong, somebody has to be blamed. If there's a birth defect, they blame the hospitals or the doctors or themselves. The attitude is quite different in countries with a belief in reincarnation. Blame those countries. There is this third component, not denying some role to genetics and environment, but there is the component of some existence before the conception of the current body. The child bears some responsibility for what he does and says and how he develops. It's interesting to see Indian parents talking with some of these children who claim to have had superior status or greater wealth in a previous life. They will say, "All right, that was the way things were, now you're with us and we're in the jungle and you're going to have to adjust to things the way they are now." A Western parent with an unusual child doesn't have that kind of defense. The whole thing would be very baffling to them. If the child shows unusual behavior and claims to remember a previous life, the average Western parent is totally at sea without any kind of sail or rudder. I think that reincarnation offers a third component to the formation of human persona. If reincarnation occurs, we must be built of layers going back to some remote distance I know not where. But there must be a pre-existence, and that pre-existence contributes very importantly to human personality. 83 Chapter 19 Dead Men's Hands. It is the secret of the world that all things subsist and do not die, but only retire a little from sight and afterwards return again. Nothing is dead. People feign themselves dead, and endure mock funerals and mournful obituaries, and there they stand, looking out of the window, sound and well in some strange new disguise. Ralph Waldo Emerson in A Village in Northern India. We filmed a youth, born with no fingers on his right hand, talking about his previous life as a boy whose fingers had been accidentally cut off by a fodder chopping machine. Afterwards, we gave him a lift to a house in a village 8 kilometers away, where he was greeted as a son by the woman whose own child had died a year after the accident. Both families and the boy are convinced he is a reincarnation of that maimed child. The parapsychologists felt it was a strong case, with one possible weakness - the comparatively short distance between the two villages meant information about the dead child would have been available in the area. But the coincidence of a boy born without fingers on the same hand as the one mutilated on the unrelated dead child is dramatic. Professor Stevenson told me, there is a medical condition called short fingers which is extremely rare. Usually cases are born without fingers on both hands. To have just one hand affected is even more unusual. A Danish survey of birthmarks suggested it might occur once in 500,000 births. Stevenson's forthcoming volumes are about dozens of cases like this, children who have not only memories, but birthmarks and deformities corresponding to traumatic injuries sustained by someone, often at the point of death. Such birthmarks may match knife wounds or the points of entry and exit of bullets as recorded in autopsy and other medical records. Stevenson's careful scientific analysis of such compelling evidence should cause a scientific furore. He told me, I think these are tremendously important cases because they add a more objective element to the kinds of testimony we have heard up to now. The new element is the documentary and medical evidence supporting the idea of seemingly shared physical characteristics between the child and the dead person he claims to have been. Here, for example, is a photograph of a Turkish child born with one ear virtually absent. He remembered her life as a peasant farmer in Turkey who, at the end of the day, fell asleep in a pasture. A neighbor came along hunting rabbits in the twilight and shot him with a shotgun at point-blank range. In this case, as with about 40 other cases, we managed to get medical documentation of the location and appearance of the wound. In this case, a hospital report showing the man died 10 days later of a brain hemorrhage because the pellets had penetrated the skull. This boy had memories of that man's life, and because of his birth defect and the medical documents, I consider this one of our stronger cases. The example we decided to study for our television series was the boy with no fingers on his right hand. At the University of Virginia, Dr. Stevenson showed us a photograph of a fodder chopping machine, rotating circular blades looking like a bicycle wheel mounted on a stand and turned at speed by a handle. A few months later, we were filming one of these machines in northern India. It stood ominously in the background as we watched the youth, now aged 18, being questioned by the Indian parapsychologist Dr. Satwant Pasricha of the National Institute for Mental Health and Neurosciences, Bangalore. Pasricha and Stevenson have worked together on many of these cases in India. The youth's memories of his other life have faded somewhat since his younger days and the earlier interviews with Stevenson and Pasricha. But what he said in Hindi was dramatic enough. I died and I was born here. I used to recall it. He described how he contacted the family of the previous personality. There was a wedding in our village and my brothers, from the previous life, had come to attend. I recognized them. I knew they were my brothers. My present parents didn't know, but gradually everybody came 84 to know of it. I went to my brothers and recognized them and everyone said, tell us, how was your hand cut? And my mother, of the previous personality, said they would believe I was their son only if I could show them the machine by which my hand was cut. I went there and the machine was fixed in another room. I showed them the machine and everybody agreed that I was Kamandal's son. Dr. Pasricha asked the youth if he remembered how the fingers had been lost. My previous father used to drink and he came home in the evening and rotated the machine and my hand was chopped. I kept standing there and he realized about my hand when all the fingers fell off. Then everybody became concerned. I was taken to hospital for treatment. Do you remember what hospital? No, I don't remember. Do you remember who took you? My father, by cart, by bullock cart. Later that day, we walked across the fields from the boy's village and all drove to a farm 8 kilometers distant. The boy entered the house where the dead child had lived. There he greeted his mother and older brother with respect and affection. Dr. Pasricha talked with the mother who confirmed meeting the boy when her family went to the wedding of a relative in his village. Dr. Pasricha asked if the boy was truly her son. Yes, of course he is my son. He considers me his mother and I consider him to be my son. The older son, a security official, was equally convinced. He was my brother in the previous life, therefore he is my brother. I remember the wedding ceremony 5 years ago. I was there with 3 or 4 of my brothers and he recognized us. He recognized my mother and my father. He told us how his hand was cut and said people beat him. He said, please take me to live with you, and I said we would. When we were about to leave next morning, his mother stopped us, saying, but this is Sanjay. I said that's all right, accept us as your family too, you will now have 7 more brothers. He stayed with us for a month. Today, the young man treats both houses as his home. At his natural home, Dr. Pasricha asked him which one he preferred. When I go there I long for this house, when I am here, I long for the other one. I like living in both. Dr. Pasricha told me the researchers had found no similar case of a hand deformity in the village. Accidents with fodder chopping machines were few. They had also researched back some generations into the two families and could find no examples of deformed hands. The weaknesses of the case, she said, were the relative proximity of the two families and the fact that as a child the boy had given few details of his previous life. The strength of the case was obvious to all, the stark testimony of that mutilated hand. Back at the University of Virginia, Dr. Stevenson showed me photographs of another child born without fingers. This was an equally dramatic case of a young Burmese woman, now married, who remembered a previous life as a man who had humiliated his wife by taking a mistress. The wife committed suicide and the wife's mother vowed vengeance on the husband. She hired professional killers who waylaid him as he was bicycling home from a wedding. They took him down a slope and killed him with a sword, the principal weapon of murder in Burma. Stevenson continued the tale. The last memory of the previous life the subject has is holding up the hands in a gesture of supplication. Please don't kill me, spare me. It also wards off the first blow. To get a good cut at the neck, the swordsman usually chops the fingers and the victim is killed that way. Their child, when she first had these memories, actually remembered the ring that she was wearing and I think a watch. They got into the field of vision of the deceased just as he was going to be killed and somehow got carried over into her memories. We have photographs showing her very badly deformed hands with some fingers seriously mutilated and 1 or 2 other marks from sword cuts. Another case in Burma involved a hanging which was bungled. The person hanged was a notorious brigand, a dacoit who had terrorized the whole territory of Upper Burma for a few years. He was captured, charged with murder, convicted and sentenced to death. But the hanging was bungled, so he was hanged twice. The subject was born with memories of this brigand and with an almost absent lower jaw. His mandible was exceedingly small and his mouth very narrow and tight, so he really could only take liquid food and couldn't open his mouth very much. I have photographs showing the constriction and his profile shows his lower jaw is 85 very poorly developed. He had a memory of the first hanging, but by the time we met him his memories were beginning to fade. I think it's an authentic case, so if reincarnation is the best explanation then the mental images he had of the tight sensation in his neck, that preceded his death, are the images of the bungled hanging and that somehow became the stimulus for an effect on the body of the person he became in the next life. Stevenson showed us equally dramatic photographs of another Turkish case, a child who remembered a previous life as a miller. One day, some customers quarreled. One man wanted his grain milled immediately although there was a queue of other people waiting. The miller became embroiled in the fight and somebody picked up a flour shovel and struck him on the back of the head. This child had memories of the deceased Miller and a very severe deformity at the back of the head, corresponding to the bashing on the head with the flour shovel. Again, we were able to get a post-mortem report confirming that the Miller had indeed died from being hit on the head. The thoroughness of Stevenson's efforts to get factual verification for his cases was illustrated by photographs of the body of an American who died from being shot in the chest by a shotgun at close range. This showed a circle of small red wounds, but this was not the corpse of someone in a reincarnation case. It was simply Stevenson finding out what someone would look like when shot in the center of the chest from a certain distance. The case was of a boy in India born with an exceedingly prominent birthmark in the center of his chest, an area of decreased pigmentation. He remembered the previous life of a man who was shot at point-blank range with a shotgun by an unknown assassin. It was probably a case of mistaken identity, for the man shot was a harmless Indian villager who seems to have had no enemies. We did get an autopsy report from the hospital, and the correspondence between the shotgun wounds on the deceased man and the birthmarks is exceedingly close. The weakness of the case is that the deceased man and the boy lived in the same village and there had been some slight acquaintance between the families, but I still consider this a very strong case. Some of the birthmarks that correspond to memories of another life are moles, blemishes on the skin which Stevenson says might be due to genetics. Certain types of birthmarks are quite common and could by coincidence tie in with the story of someone's death. In most of the cases you could not introduce a genetic factor because the families are totally unrelated. Also, the birth defects in these cases are uncommon. They are not the sort you find in textbooks or monographs, with rare exceptions. In particular, we have a collection of about 15 cases where there are two birthmarks corresponding to bullet wounds of entry and exit. Forensic pathologists know that nearly always when you shoot somebody, the bullet wound of entry is small and round and the bullet wound of exit is large and irregular. That's the way our birthmarks are in about half of these cases. I find that very impressive. Stevenson is perfectly well aware that many of the cases he has investigated are not perfect, but it does not seem to bother him particularly. We know some of our cases have what you might call petty blemishes. There may be some exaggeration or distortion, many may have that kind of error. In fact, if they didn't have flaws, you'd be suspicious, wouldn't you? You'd wonder if they had all been cooked up. One of my teachers used to say that if you have the perfect case, you really should be suspicious that it has all been rehearsed. So you kind of expect and welcome a few mistakes. It's a sign in a way that people are genuine and not rehearsed. 86 Chapter 20 Possessed. We may know certain phenomena and even the laws which govern their appearance, but we do not adequately understand a single one of them. 8 To say of a stone which falls to earth that it obeys an attraction, which varies directly as the mass and inversely as the square of the distance, is not to understand the stone's fall. Professor Charles Richeau on this case on L9 July 1985, Sumatra. A young married woman in Sharifpura, a remote village in northern India, seemingly died. Funeral arrangements were being discussed when she suddenly recovered, but insisted she was someone else. She said the people about her were strangers, and she described the life of another young woman named Shiva who had been murdered on the 17th of May 1985, 2 months earlier. Sumatra seemed possessed. The position remains the same today. Dr. Pasricha and our television team arrived unannounced at Sumitra's home, and her first words to Dr. Pasricha were, "Don't call me Sumatra. I'm Shiva." This strange case is one of 350 varied claims of reincarnation Dr. Pasricha has studied in India over the past 17 years. A survey in northern India a few years ago suggested that perhaps 1 in 500 children may have some memory of another life, but cases of possession are rarer. Sumatra Singh of Etawah district in India appeared to die and then revived, having apparently lost all awareness of her former personality but rather showing the knowledge, behaviors and personality traits of a quite different woman, Shiva Tripathi, who had lived in the same district but had died suddenly by being crushed by a railway train 2 months earlier. More at Etawah, a medium-sized town several hours' journey away from the village where the seemingly possessed Sumitra lives, Dr. Pasricha talked to the parents of Shiva. The circumstances of her death, in the village where she lived with her husband's family, were suspicious. Shiva, a university graduate, had married into a poorly educated family and there was a history of quarrels before the girl's body was found with head injuries near a railway line. Her in-laws suggested the unhappy Shiva had committed suicide, but Shiva's own family did not believe this story. They hurried to the village to get Shiva's body expertly examined and to press police to investigate, but when they arrived they found Shiva had already been cremated. The husband had not waited for any of Shiva's family to attend the ceremony. Members of the husband's family were arraigned on charges in connection with the girl's death at the instigation of her father, but ultimately there was not enough evidence to convict. Shiva's father, a school teacher, stood on the roof terrace of his home and told Dr. Pasricha a remarkable story. His daughter had died in May and a few months later he heard someone say she had been reincarnated in the village of Sharifpura. By October, he had the address and went to see her. When I reached the house they called her from the adjoining room. She ran into the room and hugged me. I said, "How do you know me?" She said, "You are my Papa Ramsrayan Tripathi." I asked her, "What is your name?" And she replied, "Aruna Tripathi." I said, "That is what they call you at school, but what is your nickname? What you are called at home?" She replied, "Shiva Tripathi." Then I started weeping and she told me everything. She asked about all the other children at home. I stayed at their house that night and brought her home the next day. I asked my wife to hide in Shiva's room. There were a number of ladies in the living room and I asked Shiva to identify her mother from amongst these women. She could not. She then went to her own room and hugged and embraced her mother. Then she recognized her brothers and all the neighbors. I felt as if she was my own daughter, as she had always been. Everything was familiar, the way she walked, sat down, got up. 87 Then she told us some things that were uncanny. There was a road which has been reconstructed and she pointed this out and gave details about what it had looked like before. She recognized her own watch and all her clothes and sarees. I was fully convinced that she was Shiva. We asked her to write letters to us and she wrote her name in the way that our daughter used to and with which we were so familiar. She came home to us for 1.5 months and her way of living at home and her manner was the same as Shiva's. We never had any doubts that our Shiva had come back to us. The girl told the teacher that his daughter had been murdered. There had been a prolonged quarrel with Shiva's mother-in-law over a visit the girl wanted to make to her own family. Eventually, she was asked to come downstairs and talk things over. She was hit on the head with a brick and lost consciousness. She remembered nothing more until she woke up in Sumitra's body. Shiva's mother Amrani verified her husband's story. My husband asked her to identify her mother in the crowd of women assembled in our house. She said, "Mummy is not here." My husband asked her to find Mummy. She ran into the room where I was hiding, embraced me and started crying. I felt this was my daughter because she remembered us and everything about her life. She was very affectionate towards me, my husband and her brothers. She would talk about her children, her husband's house and her husband. She remembered and talked about her sarees and quite clearly recognized everybody. Dr. Pasricha asked whether she thought someone might have given the girl clues as to the family's identity. No. She recognized us very spontaneously. She remembered her parents, her brother, even her uncle. I realized that this was Shiva. Of course, her body had been burned. But her spirit was living on in someone else's body. We still believe she is our daughter. She doesn't look like our daughter but her spirit is still there. Sumitra's home in Sharifpura is much more remote from Etawah than the distance of 65 kilometers indicates. It took us 4 hours to get there. Single track lanes petered out to nothing and we abandoned our minibus with a flat tire stuck on a narrow bridge. A farmer's tractor and trailer bounced us for half an hour to this isolated village. It was dusk when we got there and all the village children turned out to cheer. Fortunately, Sumitra and her father agreed to talk to us. By the light of candles, her father told us how his daughter had appeared to die on the 19th of May 1985. She had been subject to attacks, like epilepsy, since the birth of a child. It was a Sunday, her problems began at 2 o'clock and she was dead by 4 o'clock. We waited for 2 to 4 hours and then prepared for the last rites, the funeral. Then she started breathing once again and we were overjoyed. Dr. Pasricu asked, "How did you know that she was dead?" The doctors told us. Her heart had stopped beating. She had no pulse and her body was cold. So we believed she was dead. But after recovering consciousness, she couldn't recognize us. For about 4 days, we talked with her and she spoke in an unusual manner. It was not the voice we knew. She said, "This is not my house. I live with my husband and my in-laws in Divyapur. I grew up in Etawah." We were dumbfounded. We could not believe what had happened. She said her father was Ramsrayan. We did not know who he was, where his house was, just that he lived in Etawah. Finally, somebody managed to contact him and he came to see her and she recognized him instantly as her father. We also spoke to Sumitra, seemingly alive and well. She lowered her veil and Dr. Pasricha began, "Tell me, Sumitra." "Don't call me Sumitra. I am Shiva. Tell me, if someone comes to the world with a certain self-identity, can that identity ever change?" "Dr. Pasricha, but yours did change." "Yes, but now that I am Shiva, how can I become Sumitra again?" "Dr. Pasricha, do you remember your life as Sumitra?" "I remember nothing. I have no recollection. I have been told about Sumitra, but that has nothing to do with my perceptions or my story. I can only tell you about my life as Shiva." "Dr. Pasricha, what do you remember about the life of Shiva?" "Everything. All of which I have told you before. That I had 2 children and the way I was murdered." Dr. Pasricha has gathered some impressive facts about this case. Sumitra named Shiva's father before there was any contact between the 2 families and later identified 14 members of Shiva's family from photographs. In all, she recognized 22 people known to Shiva. Sumitra had never been to any school but taught herself enough to be able to write simple notes to her mother. Since being possessed by Shiva, there has been an improvement, 88 inches, the girl's ability to write and read Hindi. This is not surprising since Sumitra was an illiterate 17-year-old when she was apparently replaced by the more educated Shiva, who was 22 when she was found dead by the railway line. There have been other differences in the subsequent behavior of Sumitra. She began dressing differently, wore sandals instead of going barefooted and began speaking to her parents in a more polite and formal way. Is it possible the whole story is a hoax, a pretext got up by these peasant farmers, perhaps based upon newspaper accounts of the death of Shiva and the prosecution of her in-laws? Dr. Pasricha thinks it unlikely. One newspaper is delivered to the village and is available for anyone to read. Newspaper reports of Shiva's death have been analyzed and Sumitra has given 16 correct items of information not carried in press reports. How then could Sumitra have acquired her information about Shiva's life? One would need a private detective in Etawah or several accomplices to put together a plot for which no clear motive has emerged in the past 5 years. The idea of an elaborate con trick gives a sophistication to simple villagers that is ridiculous to anyone who has been to this inaccessible spot and met them. Dr. Pasricha also introduced us to a good example of a more orthodox reincarnation case, Manju Sharma, a 20-year-old girl who remembered an earlier life as a 10-year-old who drowned in a well. Manju, now married with 2 small children, spent 10 years of her life with the parents of the dead girl, where she was known only as Krishna. Today, Manju lives in the town of Brindavan in northern India, whose temples are places of special pilgrimage for Hindus. Here the Lord Krishna is reported by the scriptures to have played with the local cowgirls. The apartment where Manju lives is next door to a shrine. Dr. Pasricha talked to her on a balcony overlooking a bustling courtyard, typifying India, Children recited holy texts for a teacher, carrot spoiled over a smoky fire for a communal stew, and an infant shrieked because a large monkey had stolen his banana. Manju was one of Dr. Pasricha's early cases, and the memories have faded a little. She no longer has a fear of wells.